Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell. And today we're going to be talking a little bit about psychiatry and the sort of genetic makeup of people that might predispose them to psychiatric problems. But why do some people have psychiatric disorder? So today, to sort of look into this whole business of the genetic makeup of people and the potential for psychiatric disease, we're going to be talking to Dr. Michael Escamilla. He's at the Texas Tech University Health Science Center in El Paso, Texas. And Michael, welcome to Science Studio.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
Before we get into, you know, the genetic makeup of people that predisposes them for psychiatric issues, let's learn a little bit about Michael. How did Michael become a scientist, go out and get an MD degree, and sort of be doing research in this genetic framework?
Well, it's a long story. It starts in childhood. I was one of those, I guess, more unusual children who, like, for a Christmas present at age 7, wanted a chemistry set.
Well, good for you.
and a microscope and things like that. So somehow very early, I would say elementary school or a little bit after that, just got fascinated with science. And it was certainly from the teachers and the classes.
And your parents, would they have any background in science or anything like that?
Tangentially, my father is a doctor. A surgeon.
Right.
My mother is a nurse.
Okay,
so the medical fields.
Right. But, so the microscope was a big deal then, right?
Yes.
You could see little bacteria wandering around.
I found that fascinating.
More so than the chemistry set, maybe.
Well, the chemistry set I had even more fun with, I think, because you could make these different concoctions. And I was very – I liked the mechanisms of putting things together and changing, you know, transforming
absolutely
substances. And I think they had different colors. That's how you could tell they were changing.
The colors always is a delightful issue.
Yes.
All right. And still to this day, I mean, there are so many indicators and sensors that, you know, by molecule or species A interacting with species B, a color change occurs, and therefore you know that one of them is there.
Right.
It's a wonderful – the litmus paper, of course, is the most famous. But we now have all these genes, in fact, that turn on different colors. And
exactly.
Green fluorescent proteins and God knows what.
Yeah, amazing.
So anyway, right from the early age discovered.
I was interested. And then in college, studied genetics. Biochemistry was the major. But I got very interested in genetics, which was really becoming an exciting branch of science at that time. Wasn't quite sure what I would do after college. Took a year and worked in a laboratory just as a research technician. And I was torn between graduate school, following that path, versus becoming a doctor, which from my parents, that's what I knew as an interesting career that could help people and –
and bring respect to the
family. Respect, but also the issue was, how could I do something that I would be interacting with people, but still being able to use science in some way.
Right.
And medical school at the beginning is very, very focused on science. You really need to learn the mechanisms of the body and the genetics, the biochemical structures. So it seemed like a natural way to continue. And I just didn't know what I would do once I finished medical school, you know, and even which track of medicine to follow.
You didn't think of the MD, PhD program where you combine
I thought about
these two
it.
Degrees.
They did have that at the school that I went to in Dallas.
This is UT Southwestern.
Right.
I mean, one of the finest research, teaching, you know, medical schools in the country, in the world.
Oh, yeah. It really is incredible. And there certainly was that program, so I thought about it. But we had two scientists there, and one of them was an MD who hadn't never gotten the PhD, Michael Brown, I believe.
Yeah, I know. Nobel laureate.
A Nobel laureate, right? So I had that as one possible path, that you could finish your MD and then do research afterwards with the doctorate of an MD. And that was also a legitimate path to be able to be a scientist and a medical doctor. So at the time, I think I just wanted to get through medical school and quickly, which was a four-year program, versus the MD, PhD would have been 6 or 7 years or so.
Right, exactly. So, but on the other hand, I mean, just for any students who are thinking about this out there, I mean, if you go for the MD, PhD, you get paid to do this. you don't come out with any
debt. So that
right. So I mean, saving.
I think I didn't realize that because that could have helped quite a bit down the line.
And Dr. Brown of the Nobel fame is always talking to students and saying, look, you don't need the PhD. Just get the degree and then
right.
you know, follow your nose yes. and get into the research.
Yes.
So it's a pathway.
Right. So that's how I did that. But I think it was in the third year of medical school that I did the psychiatry rotation and became fascinated with psychiatry and in particular schizophrenia. I saw some patients with schizophrenia and I found it an extremely debilitating illness but very strange and hard to understand.
Let's define I mean, from the medical and scientific point of view if you can – schizophrenia, because it's a word that you hear a lot of.
Okay. I'll do my best because it's a complicated topic actually. So schizophrenia is one of the diagnoses that psychiatrists give to certain people, and it's based on a set of symptoms that they have. But it was a term that was invented just about 100 years ago. So it's a recent term. It describes a person who has difficulties with either hallucinations where they hear voices or sounds that aren't there for other people, or they have visual hallucinations. They may also have delusions. This is a very tricky concept, but this is where someone has a thought or a belief that is really quite bizarre or unshared by other people. And so those are the major symptoms. Now, there are other forms of schizophrenia where those are not as prominent, but they have – it's people who have really great difficulty with thought process, communication, bizarre behaviors. So it may be the way they act more so than the way they think. But it's quite a grab bag of symptoms. The most classic – though that we hear the most about are persons who have those delusions or the hallucinations.
And would it be true to say then that anyone that you've diagnosed with this as an issue has the potential to be harmful to themselves and to society? Or can you have many people just live quite a normal life filled with
their delusions? You can have many people who live quite a normal life filled with delusions. I mean, it might sound hard to believe, but probably 1% of the human race, and pretty much in all cultures, have the severe form of delusions or hallucinations that we call schizophrenia. So it's about 1 in 100 people.
And
it's
the level
common.
Of education doesn't have any role
doesn't
in
matter,
this.
I mean, no.
You can still have this problem and apply yourself for a successful career in something.
You can, but that 1% that has the severe form, they really have great difficulty functioning. You can. And in fact, I recently met another Nobel Prize winner who has schizophrenia a few months ago.
All right. And he knows this. Well, she
knows yes. This. And it's publicly known. John Nash is the name of the scientist. But his onset of schizophrenia happened, I believe, while he was at an early stage of his career. So I think the Nobel was based on work he did right before that.
Okay.
But he still functions and still right. teaches. And so it is possible. But again, that severe form, which we call schizophrenia, is pretty disabling. I would say most people with that disorder can function, can find work, can have families, but they have a great difficulty and a lot of challenges to do
that. And they would be recognized by the rest of society, their family, as having an issue?
Not always. Okay. Not always. For instance, there's a form called paranoid schizophrenia, which is mainly – the main symptom is the delusions. And otherwise, they function intellectually just fine, no problem. And you may not even know unless you were, you know, maybe really closely involved with them. You might notice some odd thoughts or ideas that they would say once in a while.
I mean, have you met patients who are in that category that actually understand from time to time that another part of their life is a little bit mixed up with delusion.
Yes. Yes.
So I mean,
in fact, that's what we do in therapy with someone with schizophrenia is we slowly work with them so they can understand this is maybe this thought is not really based on fact. Maybe it's just an idea, and then eventually they can get to the point where they know it's a delusion. They still have it; it comes up, but they're able to not follow it.
And so, 1% of the population.
1%.
So we're
and there's a larger percent that has delusions. So that 1% is what we call schizophrenia, which is the severe form, where the delusions are so great that it impairs their functioning. In terms of delusions in general, though, there's almost a fine point between people's individual beliefs and when they become delusions. Like some people might even say certain religions are delusions, you know,
yes.
at one point or another. So it's actually almost a philosophical topic where you draw that line.
Well, I can imagine. I mean, let me think a moment for about dreams. I mean, quite often in dreams we put ourselves in positions where we are doing things that we, if we were awake, we knew we wouldn't be able. My sister always had dreams about somehow being on a horse leading like Queen Boadicea, all right? I mean, she's a mild, mild lady, but she has these dreams,
right?
She likes to talk about them.
Sure.
And,
sure.
You know, I have all sorts of funny dreams.
Yes.
I dream that I fly. I mean, literally, I'm flying.
Yes.
I mean, but I gather that's
Do
quite
you still,
common.
Even at this age? I used to have those as a child, but,
oh, no.
But they sort of stopped
well,
as
I mean,
life
you know,
went
I
on.
Don't get them every night, but I mean,
okay.
I get one or two
yep.
every year.
They're great dreams,
right?
aren't
and
they?
And I just stand still and then sort of throw myself under the air and I'm off.
Yeah.
So and is that delusional? Am I?
No, it's a dream. It's a dream.
So
it's,
what's the difference?
What's the difference is you're asleep. Now, but this gives
yeah, right.
If
so
you
I'm
have
a schizophrenic
if
when I'm asleep.
Well, you could say that. The thought processes that happen in dreams are thought to be very similar to the thought processes that are happening in schizophrenics. Some people would say there's two levels of thought. There's an unconscious thought process, which in the unconscious, all types of bizarre things can happen, and you can fly, and anything can happen. Things can morph together. You can have all types of unusual events. But the other type of thinking is when we're awake, we tend to use more of a rational thinking. And that unconscious sort of fades down during the daytime. During sleep, it comes back up. So if you wanted an idea of what a schizophrenic person might feel during the daytime, think about some dreams, especially dreams in which a lot of people have dreams where they're being persecuted or people
okay.
are breaking into the house right. or things. This is maybe what a person with schizophrenia feels like during the daytime.
I mean, there was a dream I used to have up until quite recently, and that I somehow got called back to my high school, grammar school, because the math test came back that I hadn't passed.
Yes,
and that
yes.
was that. That's a nightmare almost.
Absolutely, and I have that one too, except it's college.
You're
and it's always my math class, my calculus class.
Okay. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Dr. Michael Escamilla from the Texas Tech University Health Science Center in El Paso. And we'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Millions of Americans take statins such as Lipitor and Zocor, which are cholesterol-lowering drugs. Along with preventing heart disease, these drugs may have an added benefit of keeping someone from going blind.
A large study confirms anecdotes that statins prevent glaucoma, a common eye condition in people over 40. Yet about half of those with glaucoma don't know they have it.
Glaucoma develops when pressure slowly increases in the eye from a fluid buildup. Normally, a small amount of fluid is produced and drained daily to nourish parts of the eye that do not have blood vessels and maintain the proper amount of pressure between the various parts of the eye.
But with glaucoma, the fluid does not drain, and eventually the person can't see as well or at all when the optic nerve is damaged. That's the bundle of nerves carrying information from the retina to the brain.
The new study looked at 300,000 people who've been on statins for 2 years to control their cholesterol. They had about a 10% lower risk of developing the most common form of glaucoma, open-angle glaucoma. And the drugs worked best in the early stages of the disease.
It's not clear how statins do this. The drugs may improve blood flow to the optic nerve and retinal nerve cells and help drain the aqueous fluid to reduce pressure in the eye.
People most at risk for glaucoma are African Americans, Hispanics, diabetics, people over 60, and those with a family history. Once glaucoma robs their sight, it's irreversible.
But this can be easily avoided by yearly visits to the ophthalmologist along with a visit to your family doctor.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Michael Escamilla, Dr. Michael Escamilla, Texas Tech University Health Science Center, and we're talking about dreams, schizophrenia. Now, let's talk a little bit about the genetic aspect of this. Are we getting close to the idea that, you know, you can take a piece of my blood and you can say, ha, 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 borderline schizophrenic, or you can take somebody else and say, no chance, and now another one that's full-blown? Are we getting close to having a genetic predisposition for schizophrenia?
We are getting closer, and so we're getting, bit by bit, we're starting to uncover genes that increase your risk for schizophrenia. This, in the same way that we're finding genes that increase your risk for Alzheimer's or diabetes or, you know, any other medical condition you can think of. But in the last, I would say, last 10 years, we've really been starting to discover what the genes are. And it's many genes. And each of them confer a very small increased risk. So we're not at the stage, and probably never will be, where you could take someone's blood sample and say, you have schizophrenia, or you're going to have schizophrenia for sure. But I think we will never get there. But we will be able to say you have a risk. So for instance, even as a child, you can look at someone's DNA and say this person has a risk based on their DNA and based on traumatic experiences they may have had. They have a 2 times greater risk of developing depression than someone else. And we can do that for schizophrenia now. But all we can say is your risk is maybe 3 or 4% greater than the average person. So
3 or 4%.
Yeah, so tiny.
Although, I mean, that's
it,
almost
it doesn't tell you
statistical
much.
Noise.
It doesn't tell you much.
Right.
It's known already that genes are not completely the cause of schizophrenia. They are a contributor to it. So it's certain genes and environmental factors. The environmental factors we don't quite know yet. So the genetics will tell us some part of the story, but will never tell the whole story.
So, I mean, if you take people that are very clearly, from the medical point of view, full-blown paranoid schizophrenics, for example, and you have to ask permission to get their blood, I suppose you just get
yes.
by virtue of treatment. Do you have to ask permission for the
yes.
genetic analysis?
Absolutely, yes.
And they always say yes?
Yeah. At this point, it's all at the stage of research. It's not being used in clinical practice. So in any study like this, you would have volunteers who would give you a blood sample and they would know what we're doing, why we're doing it, and be in agreement.
When you think about the human genome, I mean, we share so much. Right, and then we sometimes have little variations here, some mutations over there.
All
whatever.
Of us do, yeah.
Right, and so probably in one form or another, I mean, we all carry enough genetic information that could be triggered, and so it's that onset, that turn on idea, and that's always got, it seems to me, to be environmental, whether it's what we eat, whether the pressure we feel in our jobs. So
absolutely,
you know, it's almost like saying, as you said, the 2 to 3% variation. I mean, I do a trick in my classes. Halfway through the semester, I'll just come in and say, I'm going to ask you to do something. I'm going to give you 7 seconds. And I count down. I said, count the number of people in the room. Right? The error in this is phenomenal. 30%.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The number's either 50 or it's nothing, right? Or 51 if they forget to count themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so I say, now you know about experimental error. And
right.
So when we say in science 5%, that's almost pretty good, like being there is no error.
Yeah, you could say that. But Yeah, I agree. And the question is, does it have any clinical significance?
Okay.
You know, to give you that much more risk, does that really mean anything? This gets into the area of personalized medicine. That endeavor is to be able to take people's genes and predict what illnesses they're going to have, or once they have an illness, look at what form of the illness they have genetically, and that's used to guide the treatment. But this is going to be much more difficult for schizophrenia or mental illnesses. But the idea there is that human diseases are rarely caused by one gene that causes the disease. There are many, but they're a small percentage of all the diseases. Most diseases have different causes. So even within schizophrenia, we anticipate that there are probably 40 or 50 different causes. And if we could know, you know, on a case-to-case basis that this person has this gene, this problem, we can modify the treatment for the cellular pathway affected by that gene. So on the population level, looking at your blood sample, you maybe can't say that much. But once someone has the disease and you know which genes you're looking for, that may actually have a lot of utility in treatment and helping us to design the treatments.
So in fact, this concept of personalized medicine, I mean, it's beginning to – you hear more and more of it.
Yes.
You know, you hear it on the radio. This is brought to you by such and such university, you know, on the forefront of personalized medicine.
Right.
But it's very much we're at the cusp. I mean,
it's in the nascent stage of how – if that really is clinically useful right now.
Hmm. But I mean, I think it seems to be a panacea if you think about it.
It's somewhat of a panacea. Let's give you the example of depression, which is probably the most common psychiatric disorder. A lot of people have that. We don't know when a patient comes in exactly which medication is going to treat it best. And so there's four or five or more different types of medication. And you often – it's trial and error. You try the medication, takes a few weeks to test. You move to another one. If you could know when someone comes in what form of – biologically, which medication is going to work, you could save 8 months of
treatment.
So that's an example. That's where we want to be, but we're at the beginning stages in all branches of medicine.
Doing that
for cancer, for instance, is another goal.
And also the whole concept of epilepsy. I mean, I know of all the different levels of drugs that you're used to sort of stop this. And
right.
If only you could get a genetic framework and say, okay, now we can say this combination would be the one.
Right.
And it'll come, presumably?
Yeah. And that's one of the research projects we're doing here in El Paso is we're trying to identify genes that contribute to epilepsy with patients here in El Paso.
Well, how do you do that? What's the process of this activity?
Well, genetic research has blossomed because technologically. We can do a lot more now. So what we're doing in the neurology clinic here at Texas Tech is patients that want to participate in this. It's not for treatment. It's research. They'll give us a blood sample, and we're actually sequencing their entire genome. And we're looking at genes that we think may contribute to epilepsy. There's a lot of candidate genes and looking to see if they have particular mutations within those genes. So we've just started that project. We've already have some very promising leads to particular mutations that may be associated with epilepsy. And as we gather up those different mutations or understand which ones they are, we'll then start to test which ones do better with which treatment.
And thinking about this, the example of Iceland is always cropping up.
Oh.
You know, there's this very, very small population where they've got genetic data covering everybody and they know all the family history of disease.
Yes, yes.
Are there examples where this type of study is being done there also? In your area?
Oh, yes, absolutely. So I've worked for 20 years in a population down in Central America, the Costa Rican population. They have a history that's similar to Iceland for historical reasons. They have a large population descended from a relatively small number of founding families. And you can trace back which families go to that founding ancestry. So we actually have very complicated pedigree structures, we call them, family trees, you know, containing hundreds and hundreds of people in one particular tree. And this is just like what they're doing in Iceland.
Right.
And we're characterizing from my side, I've been interested in psychiatric disorders, but other people are looking at diabetes and asthma.
From your sort of vantage point, are psychiatric disorders really a disease or a problem or a syndrome of the developed world?
Partly. I'm going to say this with a caveat that even in the developing countries or less developed countries, they do have things such as schizophrenia. They do have people who have hallucinations or delusions. The difference is in the developed countries, the course of illness seems to be worse. In those countries, they seem to adapt into the village or the family, and people know them as just being special, having these special abilities. But they function pretty well as life goes on. In cultures like the United States and more developed countries, they end up lost on the street.
Yeah.
And
I mean,
it's a disorder of developed countries.
It's so easy to be lonely in the developed world.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, you don't have that village. And you were saying that you're getting treatment by working one-on-one almost with the psychiatric patients and sort of making them understand that maybe what they saw wasn't real.
Yes.
And in a village, you know, everyone's there.
Yes.
Right, to help them.
Right. And sometimes in some cultures, for instance, Native American culture, someone would have a vision like that and it would be incorporated into the saga of the tribe.
All right.
Right? So that person would actually be valued for having had that vision.
Yeah, we create religions out of things like
that,
don't we?
Sure. Right. You could say that.
Michael Escamilla. Dr. Michael Escamilla from the Texas Tech University Health Science Center in El Paso, Texas. We've had an interesting conversation, and I'd like to thank Norma Martinez for making sure this program gets properly put together so you enjoy it out there, and we'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Miguel Velez Reyes, a UTEP electrical and computer engineer, is working with a clinical research stage medical device company to help develop a non-invasive skin technology. It will allow doctors to provide earlier detection of conditions like infections, bed sores, and cancer. Reyes is developing algorithms for the technology. Read more at Synapse. Go to mcasynapse.org.